Good morning. My name's Kevin Farley. I'm here with some distinguished guests to talk about SQL Server 2012 in-memory OLTP, but from a customer deployments and lessons learned perspective. So you've been hearing from various people in the SQL Server team this week about the technology, about in-memory OLTP. Hopefully you've learned a lot and enjoyed the sessions, but we thought it would be very impactful for you to hear about what this looks like when it hits the ground in companies like yours. So we've brought three of our early adopter customers in to talk about their experiences. We've got Rick Kuchera from BWIN, Mike Steineke from EdgeNet, and Iman Rivera from Microsoft's IT. He runs one of the systems in our SQL Server's own operations department. So I figure it's one thing for the team that made the product to tell you it's great. Have a different impact if you hear it from the people who are actually using it in production and find out why they thought it was worth it to their business to implement this, what their challenges were, and what the results were. So that's the flow of this talk, and as such, I'm going to give them the majority of the time. I'll give some context and do some wrap-up, but the majority of the time is going to be spent with them. So we talked about application patterns and various different sessions we've given. So applications that are going to do good with in-memory OLTP, applications that are hitting a wall with SQL Server today. So you've tuned it, you've tuned your hardware, you've taken the application about as far as you can. You've got locking and latching problems going so that you can't drive your CPUs as hard as you'd like. You've got all the other bottlenecks looked at, but it's not going as fast as you want, and you still have plenty of CPU headroom, so that's not the issue. That's an instance where in-memory OLTP can help scale up applications where you've scaled up as far as the hardware you can get will take you. We can make more efficient use of that hardware so you can, again, get more for your hardware dollars. And if you have stringent throughput and latency requirements, that's another case where this technology can really benefit, because this is all about higher throughput, especially with lower locking and latching, and also decreased latencies. We also encourage you to look at situations where you might not consider using a database at all in the current scenarios, where a SQL Server with in-memory OLTP may give you the speed and ability to tackle those sorts of application patterns. So some of the common scenarios that we've seen that have been very successful in the TAP program, we started the TAP program about 2 years ago plus. I managed the TAP program with a number of different customers going into production early before this product was released. Some of the common scenarios that worked really well were session state management, where you have very high throughput requirements, but not necessarily requirement for durable data. High data input rate, what we call the shock absorber scenario, where you have a flood of data coming in that then gets drained out, or just a flood of data coming in to deal with. ETL and read scale, where you've got a large flow of data coming in and then it gets queried out. And then latency critical OLTP. And as such, we've got customers that represent those different patterns. We have BWIN, and SQL Common Labs are two of the scenarios. EdgeNet is coming in. SBILM is not here. They're a Japanese company that weren't able to make it. I've got some slides. If we have time, I'll talk through those, but I think the most effective use of our time is to hear from the customers themselves. With that, I'll hand it over to Rick.
Thanks, Kevin. Now I have my mic. Hello, everyone off of my side. I'm Rick. I'm from BWIN. And as you maybe hear from my accent, English is not my native tongue, so if you have problems understanding me, don't hesitate to interrupt me. I'll try to repeat, and if you still can't understand me, I get a translator. Having said that, hackathon is cool. I think that's what Kevin wanted me to say. So I'm finished. Very well. Let's cut to the chase. Just one slide. I will not bore you with that too long. Who is BWIN? We are called an online entertainment company these days, the largest regulated online entertainment company. What we do is sports betting, poker, platform, casino, some skill games, bingo, I don't know. We have a lot of stuff. I don't even know all of that. The company profile is about 150,000 plus users every day. With just going into sports betting, we have 30,000 different sports bets daily, with approximately 1 million users joining the site every year, and a really revenue of about 650 million euro. So we are a European-based company. What's the application like that I want to talk about? Kevin said about session management. And this was the first thing that we jumped on when we adopted Hackathon, which was 3 years ago, something like that. Our scenario is that we have a big web server farm, multiple nodes for the huge amount of users that we have to cater to. And as this site is not stateless, as most sites are not these days, we need one central point to coordinate all those user requests. And this is Session State Server Database. This is actually not our product. This is something Microsoft implemented. It comes with a .NET framework. We just had the problem of using it a little bit too extensively. So when I first heard about Hackathon coming up, my first statement to the Microsoft guys was, this is it. This is what we use it for, because this is just the application. Having said that, this is not the only application we're using it for these days. Since I started migrating my servers into SQL 2014, my developers keep jumping onto that ship faster than I can move servers to it. So what's the characteristics of this application? We have a massively scaled out front end, up to 200 web servers in a single farm. We have a single database that needs to coordinate all those servers that are in the same web farm. We can't split it up, it's just one label, so there has to be a single instance. And due to the nature of the beast, every single impression that a user makes on the web page has two calls to the database. And in today's world, going to one website is not one impression, because you have all these frames, these AJAX calls, all of this, and every single one of those calls has two batches to the SQL server, one to read the session, one to write it back, which means that we can have high, very, very high peak loads, especially when you consider a sports betting website. The last 5 minutes of a soccer game or a football game or whatever, this is when things happen, and this is when everyone wants to do everything at the same time. One little side note here on the slide, the size of these objects is mostly greater than 8K. Come to that a little bit later, why this is important in that. What does this look like at the database? We generate a very high volume on the database. One page impression of a user means 30, 40, 50, depending on the page, calls to the database, just to cater that one request. We have blob-like data in there. Session state is a binary stream that gets coded and decoded by the .NET framework. The records themselves are very short-lived, and that comes in two things. One is they don't survive very long in the database at all, because once the user has done what he came to do, they will just get dropped. Session is done, finished off. The second is the user does a lot while he's on the database, so that record is very highly frequently updated. So we see about 200, 300 updates in less than a minute on the same record. But the third one is, and that's the important part here for our ideas on doing that with Hackathon, the data itself is transient. There is nothing in that session that can't be recreated. It's inconvenient for the user if we lose it, because he needs to log in again and maybe do some minor stuff again, but we do not lose business transaction if the data is hit. But on the other hand, and that's the one very important part, availability and consistency are key. Availability is key because the entire website doesn't run if this thing isn't working. Consistency is key because if a user sends 50 requests, more or less at the same time, and they get different states of his session, we might get the user a damn experience, or we might even run into a problem later on. So we thought about doing this with some kind of a NoSQL implementation, like Memcached-like things. App Fabric would be the thing in Microsoft terms. And we get very, very bad results. You have a problem with the consistency there. You have a problem with the speed in the end. So we move back to SQL because that's just what we do. give you the problem statement. Before we had hackathon, we had a scaling bottleneck. Somewhere around 15,000 batches per second, which might sound a lot at the beginning, but if you remember back on what this actually means, it's not that much on a big website. Somewhere around 15,000 batches a second, we would just stop working. Scaled, we get latch contentions to no end. And that was even when we moved the entire database into a RAM drive. So this is not about data storage. We couldn't do it any faster. This is just the way how SQL Server handles high concurrent loads. Interesting enough, it was not about locks. So this is nothing we can solve on a database level with uncommitted isolation or something like that. It was just latches, just about physical consistency. The second problem that came with it is the exponential load increase. Once you start hitting a little bit of this latch contention and the response time goes up, what happens is that some of these requests will time out and they will be retried. So when this happens, you get an exponential increase because suddenly every web server, every web browser is retrying requests like crazy just because they can't get through to their session. Which means then it gets even worse and it gets worse and it gets worse until everything crashes. And that's something we do not want to happen. The third problem on this is, and that was the hardest challenge we had on this, and Microsoft really helped us out a lot here. Oops, sorry. The client-side code of this is not something we wrote. This is part of the Internet Information Server. So the things that are taking these calls, they're actually in the .NET framework, but not in our control. Things that are creating these calls is something I cannot touch, which means whatever I do on the side of SQL Server needs to be 100% transparent to my client system. And we looked at a lot of in-memory technology in the past, but I've never seen one that can achieve that until now. So what was the result? I told you before that we had 15,000 requests as our maximum. I hope you can read that slide. If not, the number down there says 450,000. This was the latest test we did about 6 months ago or so on an Ivy Bridge DX four-socket server. 450,000, that's a 30x increase just by switching out the database engine and not even showing it to the clients. I think that clicker doesn't like me very much. Okay, now you go. What are our considerations behind it? We needed to keep 100% compatibility. I already said that. This was the absolute key thing. If IIS notices the difference, then we've lost. The second thing, and that was a problem, and still is to a certain extent, Hackathon engine, the in-memory OLTP engine, does not support large objects. A row can only be 8,000 bytes, plus minus a little bit. I'm not going into the details. And as I said before, our sessions are larger than that, all of them. Another consideration in this whole thing was 99% of the user requests do point lookups, which is something very common and widely used in OLTP. Still, the OLTP engines that we knew from the past all used some kinds of B-tree indexes. And B-trees, as you know, are good for range scans, but if you do a point lookup, it takes a little while longer than it would need to be in a perfect world. The last consideration in here is deferred durability versus no durability. We thought about this a lot, if we want to keep the data on a disk or not. In the end, we decided not to keep it at all, just let it live in memory because it doesn't really matter. Key decision behind that was, how do you do high availability with that? Because with deferred durability in the in-memory engine, you could use always-on availability groups and just do a failover if one server fails. Our decision to not use that was mainly because of consistency. Because if you have deferred durability, you cannot have 100% consistency. So there's no point in doing it in the first place. Compatibility. I already said that this is the key thing of them all. What I can say from our work in this session state engine, you can do it. if your call pattern is based on stored procedures, you can do it 100% period. And for that system, which has about 25 or so stored procedures and 3 or 4 tables below it, it took me less than a day. Convert it all into hackathon, make it happen, and that was on beta bits that only had half of what you can do with this engine right now. With ad hoc queries, so if your client really sends a query request to the database, that's a little bit more dramatic because you will see some problems with the locking and how you handle write-write conflicts and stuff like that. You still can achieve most of it. It's mostly about the error handling that you have to take care when you go down that route or have to go down that route. The thing that you need to understand, though, is the hackathon engine is not something that is built for everyone. It's not something that is built as a complete replacement for SQL. There's a lot of limitations in there that you need to be aware of. Most of them, as you will see, are things that you don't really care about in a high-load OLTP scenario. There are limitations like you can't have a constraint other than a primary key on a hackathon table. You can't have triggers. The biggest problem that we actually found is that you can't do truncate. And I had this discussion with some of the guys here just an hour ago. If you hit a table with 20,000, 30,000 and more requests per second, you can't do a delete because you will always run into a conflict in a system that is lock-free. And we can't do truncate because hackathon doesn't support it. So you need to be aware of that when you work your application. And the other thing, I've said write-write conflicts about 5 times so far. This is a concept that you are not used to when you run SQL. It is pretty similar to what you have to do with deadlocks, but there is a new concept that is coming your way if you're running the hackathon engine, so you need to keep that in mind. Which brings me to my next point, error handling. I said you can do it 100% compatible when you use stored procedures. This is the reason. There is a new concept of if 2 people write the same record at the same time, both will succeed at first, and then when you commit, one of them will fail. And that you need to take care of and do a retry logic in there, which is exactly what we do here. Catch the one error that is that comes up when you have a write-write conflict, do a delay and a retry. If some other errors come up, we just throw the error back. What you also see in here in the slight line in the middle, we built our own way of handling blobs in a form of storing them in multiple lines. Which brings me to my next point. There is no native support for large objects in the hackathon engine. Actually, at the beginning, I thought this is a very big problem, which it is not. It took me about 2 or 3 days, but I came up with a pretty easy solution to split up the binary, put it as multiple rows in the hackathon tables, and build it back together when you come out of it to the client. The entire implementation with all the source code is on my blog if somebody needs it. You have to be very cautious with consistency and zombie problems, because unless you want to hit the transaction lock in the end, you better do not do a transaction over it. So it might happen that if your request crashes in the middle, you will have some zombie records and you need to figure out a way to deal with that. Things to consider. And there could be a lot more on this slide, but I hope that the 2 guys over here will tell you something too, which is a pretty good thing in being the first one. I don't have to worry about saying things again that already have been said. The hackathon engine does not know locking in the way that you're used to it from the SQL engine so far. Not at all. As a matter of fact, if you heard the hackathon stories so far, this engine doesn't do locking at all. If you run a native compile stored procedure, it will take a CPU core, run from the beginning to the end without ever waiting for anyone. Not release that thing again, which is a pretty good thing. But if you're used to a locking behavior, like doing it in queuing scenarios with read past hints and stuff like that, that doesn't work that way. The way that hackathon does locking is something like a snapshot isolation in SQL Server. And that's just it. You have to live with that. There is no way around it, period. I hope that changes in the future at some point. I doubt it. And I think I might not like the result if it does. But we'll see. I didn't go into the detail of the second one, just wanted to point it out. If you're using hash indexes, which is one of the way cool features of the Hackathon engine, you have to specify a bucket count. And you can make or break your entire database if you get that value wrong. I know that I've ranted around this a lot. I've beaten up people a lot about it. This is just something we have to live with at these days. In every documentation I read about Hackathon, it says be very careful what you do with that. But I think they should put it in a, 70 pixel letter somewhere. The only thing I can give you there is the recommendation is take the number of records you will have in this table plus 30% or something is a good value. Well, if you are like me and you have no clue what your users are doing with their database, that might be a little challenging. If you have enough memory in your box, make it bigger. Add another zero behind it, doesn't matter. All it does is take up memory. There's no performance impact or little performance impact if you have too large of a bucket count. There is high performance impact if your bucket count is too low. Truncate is not supported, I already said that, and it's a very big thing if you have a high transaction database. The next one is even a bigger one, and I've been beating up Microsoft guys for that a lot too. There is no alter, period. No alter procedure, no alter table, no alter anything. Once you do it, it's done. And you better live with it or you start from scratch. It's not a big deal if you don't have data that is stored in these tables. It becomes a big deal once you have persisted data and have to migrate this somehow. Well, I will not say more to that. The next one is an interesting one, actually, and I hope nobody of you will ever stumble upon that. When I said, showed you the number before, the 450,000, I said we did this on a four-socket box. We always strive to get bigger and better and do higher numbers. Still, we had an eight-socket box, and the eight-socket box was actually slower. The reason for that is, and that was a very interesting thing to come across, the Hackathon engine is so terribly fast and so terribly efficient that you will find the next bottleneck, and the bottleneck is actually the intercommunication bus, the QPIs, between the processor sockets that are now not fast enough anymore to keep up with what the system is doing. So hardware scaling is a big issue, and the reason I'm saying that so explicitly is because it's very, very, very hard to spot. You will not see a lock, you will not see a latch, you will not see anything. You will see the CPU capping out at some point in the middle and not even a core capping out, every core running at 50% or so, and it will just not scale anymore. You have no idea why. It's challenging to identify, it's challenging to work around, and so far, all I can say is if you really run high-load Hackathon engines, run it on a four-socket box max, because you can't utilize an eight-socket box as of today. Watch for memory consumption. I ran into that not with the session state, but with another thing. Hackathon lives in memory, all of it, all the data, which is not a problem. So if I have a 64 gig memory in the box and I have 60 gig of data, that's cool. It just lives there and it's wicked fast. But if you have another 200 gigs of data on the disk and you only leave 4 gigs of memory left for the buffer pool, then you will not be very happy once you hit a disk-based table. And I mean that literally. And last, just to have said it again before I hand it over to Iman, be aware of missing features. This is a V1 product. It's one of the coolest V1 products I've used in a long time, and I've done SQL for a quite long time, but it's still missing a lot of things that you're used to, especially when it comes to native compile stored procedures. So be aware of that and don't stumble into it. With that, I hand it over to Iman, and if you have questions, I'll be here afterwards to answer them.
So, hi everyone, Iman Rivera, work for SQL Common Labs. It's one of our services for the Microsoft Data Platform Group. We provide all dev test support to the SQL product group. Before you get the product, we fully test that. We ensure that it's compliant with all the requirements, and we provide a clean product. So I want to see a show of hand. How many of you guys have about 128 gigs of RAM or more in your servers? Okay, pretty good. Databases larger than 1 terabyte. Okay, so for you guys, this is probably a really good scenario. We have a pretty large database. We did a good profile, good analysis of our system, and we identified some bottlenecks that probably keeping them in memory is not a good approach. Our service captures 8,100 clients. We provide telemetry, KPIs, all sorts of analysis data that we use for our improvements in our service space. Event reporting, as mentioned, captures all the data through a web service API. Then we just process it through reporting services, Power Pivot. And the problem here for us was getting all this data pushed into our system. We're seeing a lot of latching, blocking in our storage. Give you an overview of our architecture. We have the web service capturing that information they mentioned from our clients. It goes to the regular store procedures. And then from there, it gets processed, dropped into these base tables, and our reporting tools on top of it. In our new implementation, we took some of those store procedures, changed them in what we call a wrapper, that basically just calls a natively compiled store procedure. The reason because of this is to handle other constraints, like, for example, foreign key validations. Once we process data, we get it into the natively compiled store procedures, we get it into in-memory tables, and we push the current 5 minutes of data. Then we have a process that takes that cold data, anything that's older than 5 minutes, up to 30 days, and we move it into these base tables. As you can see, we have 1.5 billion records. We estimated that that will take about 128 gigs of RAM. Do we really want to keep all that, all that data in memory? Do we really need it to have it there? We just need to absorb, you know, all this input that's coming through our system. But in reality, for analysis, we don't need it to be in memory. So we went through the entire exercise. Went through AMR, we captured all the performance data, did some really nice replays, and we say, wow, nice, environment, that's my biggest contention. Same thing for contention. And finally, the sort procedure that inserts the data in that table. So it's perfect, okay, we identified the bottleneck. But guess what, it's too big. I'm not gonna waste 128 gigs of RAM just one table. So a little bit in the implementation. Finally, in the end, we ended up with around three gigs of memory consumed in three tables out of 28 user tables, 17.3 million records in event at an average. That's what we keep in memory. Then we go for each of the records that we have in that event table. We have about 300K of data per each event. So the conversion required, we converted inserts into natively compiled procedures. Mostly we just do inserts and deletes, no updates. Interop, fully supported. Wrappers for insert due to foreign key limitation. And read-all queries, recurries all our interop. We can easily do reporting on top of our database tables, in-memory tables. It's completely transparent for our customers. In the end, we increased the hardware. We put an R820 with 512 gigs of RAM, 24 core, 4 logical CPUs. And implementation, always on, fully supported. We need to provide high availability to our customers. Readable secondaries, fully supported. We can redirect our reporting traffic to our secondaries and still get the benefit from in-memory tables. And another implementation that we did is to integrate SQL Server Managed Backup to Azure. So our system automatically backups based on the logic that Managed Backup uses and sends it to an offsite, basically Azure. It took us about 1.5 weeks of coding, understanding the workload, it was a little bit interesting that move into the memory, be able to get the data out, how much memory we're using. So for us, it was a little bit complex until it finally hit the sweet spot. Going a little bit into the process of the shock absorber or the waterfall model. First of all, we use transaction isolation serializable. The reason that we do this is that we need to ensure that before we move the data into disk, we ensure that before we delete it, it's the correct data that we're going to push into, and that there are no modifications in the process. Simply just select data that we are going to insert. Simultaneously, we just delete it. This select will return from this natively compiled store procedure the data that's going to be, it's ready to be moved. We just move it to the disk space tables. Then on top of it, we have a wrapper store procedure that we specify the cutoff date, simply just, in this case, 1 hour. In this example, we tweak it. We can use minutes, seconds. And what we do is then insert to the disk space table from the output from the natively compiled store procedure. So, results. 6x gain in input rate. People ask me, why not more? Why not 30? It's like, well, I ran out of traffic. Not enough customers. I needed to push more. Should be able to push more. Another complexity for us was now the metrics that you capture, the performance counters, you have a new set. It's called XDB transactions. You will not see SQL Server transactions and XDP transactions. It's basically two separate counters. Our daily reports, we had a reduction in 30 or 80% in our queries. The reason is the hash indexes. When we do point lookups, those are amazing, really good, really fast, captures data out, incredible performance. And another thing for us is that now alerting is more in real time. We can actually see what's going through our system. We can get stack traces instantaneously from our database. Just imagine having 8,100 clients pushing errors all over the place. How are you going to capture that? How are you going to crunch that and analyze it? Really simple. Just a web service capturing within memory OLTP. Some lessons learned. First of all, use AMR. That tool set is awesome. It will help you a lot understand what's your bottleneck. And now they included some advisors that can actually analyze the data from your table, your structure, and it will tell you, can I move it? And you can just go ahead and move it. Our initial approach, again, we tried to put 1.5 billion records in memory. 175 gigs was indexes plus data. One of the other changes that we did is due to the limitations in LOBs. We had one of the columns that we were using was varchar max. We were capturing all the stack trace. In reality, just 7,000 characters of the initial size of the initial data of your stack trace is more than enough to be able to understand the exception. Foreign key limitations, wrapper store procedures, natively compiled store procedures to do validation checks into the other in-memory tables. And again, when you measure your performance, it's SQL Server transactions and your XDP transactions. And with that, I leave you with Michael for EdgeNet.
Thanks, Iman. So we'll hopefully get this to work for us. Hi, everybody. So a little bit on the EdgeNet company. We do software and services for retail, and we sell selling solutions for our customers. And one of the projects that we decided to use in-memory OLTP for was a system that provided availability of products in a store to one of our selling applications. When you go into a store to buy a product, there are multiple different things that help consumers today. There are pieces of software that the retailers have. They have those in their stores sometimes. They have them on their websites. They could be product configurators or something to help you compare products. Any of those systems have to be provided with the correct data to know what's in that store. and we develop one of these systems, if it's for one retail store, it's a pretty simple process. The set of SKUs you have in that store is relatively small, and updates to that information is also relatively small. When you're doing software like we are as a hosted service provider, we need to get all the information from a retailer for all that SKU information in their stores for all their stores. So when you start taking a store that might have 20,000 or 30,000 SKUs in it, and now I have to multiply that times 5,000 stores, and I need to know what SKUs are available, I need to know what their price is, that becomes a very complex problem. You start looking at this, and you have this data coming in all over the place. And some retailers are able to send you that data in a real-time fashion. Some have to send it to you in batches. With a standard ETL process, because I need to read this data continually and use it in other systems, that's a hard process to update that data continually because you end up with contention on the database. So it ends up looking like something of a batch process. Every night I update my availability and pricing. Well, that doesn't give the best experience for an end user. There could be in a store and they're looking at products and, oh, this is a product I want. Well, it's not available, sorry. And they don't find that out until they go to try to look for it on the shelf. So that's not a good solution. So when we learned about the in-memory architecture in Hackathon, we thought this is the solution to our business problem. So in our configuration, it's a little bit smaller than some of these other ones, but it's very volatile data. In memory, we're using about 6 gigabytes, so pretty small. And we took 2 of the 10 tables in our availability system and migrated them to in-memory. The largest table is 150 million rows. The others are about another 450,000. We're doing durability with schema and data in this, and we're using all hash indexes. So we converted this entire project, as some of these other folks were doing, through early betas of the product. So in total, it took about a week of actual time to do it, but like the others talked about, the first conversions were really, you know, a couple of days. And then as more functionality was added to the engine, we moved more and more to it and got more efficient with it, and were able to get it faster and faster throughout. As Rick mentioned, you need to be very aware in using in-memory OLTP of what the limitations are with that engine, because not all the parameters are available that you're used to in SQL Server. One thing a little different with our implementation from the others is we're actually running this in a Hyper-V VM. Since it's a smaller system, it's 16 CPUs, and we're running 128 gig of RAM on the VM. And you still need to keep in mind the things like Rick was talking about. If you have large hypervisors, that NUMA compatibility is very important. You do not want this server to be spanning NUMA nodes. So you want to be able to use the features in Hyper-V to keep that server running within one NUMA node to have that performance remain consistent. Our data is something that we're loading from files. So we use delayed durability on it, which allows us increased transaction throughput, like the data that BWIN has. We can reload it. It's transient. We don't, you know, we want it to be available and we want it to work. But if something happens to the instance, we can reload the data if necessary. So with our results, the original process required more than one SQL Server instance to do our updates, because we'd do our updates, we'd stage them, then we'd roll them to production. Now with the in-memory solution, we have one instance, and we can update that data continually while the system is being used at scale for read. Instead of having to do those batch updates every morning or every night, we can now put that data in the system as soon as we get it. So it's more real time, and if we're able to get that data from our retail customers in a real-time manner, we can load the data in a real-time manner and give the end users the best experience possible. We saw not quite the 30x that saw at BWIN for increase in performance. We saw between 8x and 11x in speed improvement in the in-memory engine. And that varied based on the size of the batch. And as we started looking at, as Rick mentioned, you start finding these other bottlenecks in your infrastructure as you start using this technology, and you have to look at it and figure out what is that bottleneck? What's going on? We found because we're loading data, and that's the main use of the application for that speed increase, we were actually read bound from our SAN. We were hitting the I/O on read to put it into memory. So we can probably go higher than that if we want to, just by giving it some more spindles or some more I/O paths. This increase for us was plenty, just to be able to reduce the operations from two servers to one and be able to update that data continually. The great speed increase with it was just an add-on. It's more of an operational thing and fixing our problem of having to get that data consistent and up-to-date for our customers. Also, that read workload is unaffected by this. We can keep loading data, and because of the optimistic concurrency that the in-memory engine uses, it's just up to date as much as it can be from when that read happens. And the data is now in sync and in near real time. So this graph kind of shows what the ETL process used to look like. If we'd get a batch from a retailer and we have to process all that data, it's 10 million rows. That standard ETL took 2 hours and 40 minutes to process. Now to process that entire same batch within memory, I can do it in 20 minutes. And like I said, I can probably do it in faster than 20 minutes if I increase my disk I/O throughput to the machine. So for our lessons learned, it's really looking at the tools like AMR, like Iman mentioned, figure out what it is that you want to migrate into in-memory. It's not the entire system. It's just key things. In our case, it was 2 tables out of 12. We started with 1. We ended up moving a second one in because we saw bottlenecks. Being able to analyze and retry and going through and testing your solution and reevaluating once you reload your system and looking at what it's processing is also very key. The last thing that we learned is we changed the key that was set up for sequencing on our systems to the natural key to use by the in-memory system. So that's really the lessons learned from our implementation. And now on to Kevin.
Thanks. I'm going to give a brief overview of another customer who isn't here, SBI Liquidity Market, and a bit of wrap-up, but also have some open Q&A sessions so you can ask these guys about their implementations and get some more data that way. SBI Liquidity Market is a currency trading market in Japan. So they're one of the largest in the world. Their annual, through the amount of trades that they handle, is a multiple of the Japanese national budget. So it's very large. Foreign currency exchange, so they are the marketplace. They aren't actual traders doing the trades. They are the marketplace, much like New York Stock Exchange is for stocks. So the project that they undertook with in-memory OLTP, they had an issue where they had a part of their process where latency was critical. The faster they could get results, the higher quality they could give, higher quality data that they could give to the traders that are actually using their marketplace. Cover management is the system that they do that. It is what comes up with the quotes for the next trade. So based on the trades that have happened in the last increment of time, it aggregates those trades, looks at the prices for a specific pair of currencies, say Deutschmark to Yen or whatever. For each pair of currencies, it's going to look at the trades that have happened in the last quantum of time, aggregate them, and come up with the price that it'll quote for the next time one of the traders asks for a quote. They're looking to expand their business globally, going out beyond their own marketplace, and they need to scale their system up. Their target is 10x the volume. System had latency up to 4 seconds at running at scale. So it would take them 4 seconds to calculate the prices for the next trades, which meant effectively that the traders and the automated trading systems are running 4 seconds behind, on running on data that was 4 seconds old. Now, the architecture that they're looking at, starting with the right side, they have trading systems that actually implement the trades. They record the trades, record what the price was paid, asked and paid for each trade for each currency pair. Each currency pair is then recorded in and aggregated together, and then that gets passed on through the systems to the one that presents the prices to the traders for the next, for them to quote their customers for the next trades. The aggregation system, where they take all the data from the trades that have happened, aggregate it, and calculate what should be the next quote, is the one that they approached with in-memory OLTP. So the implementation, they're dealing with a lot of data flowing through the system, but the data being persisted isn't that large. So the total in-memory size was about 8 gigabytes in two tables, and that held currency price pairs for all the different currencies that they handled in their marketplace. The largest table had about 100,000 rows in their trading log. The durability scheme and data, of course, they don't want to lose this data because that's their track record of how they came up with the prices that they quoted. Indexing was a mix of hash and non-clustered. In a lot of these customers that were early adopters, you'll see that they started out using all hash indexes because that was the first index we implemented. And then as non-clustered indexes came on board, they started taking advantage of those. This was a system that was designed for this technology. It was specifically developed for in-memory OLTP. And as a result, almost all of the operations were done in natively compiled procedures. So instead of having an existing system that was sitting out there that they had to decide how much of it they could fit into the surface area that we had in the version that you'll see, they were able to craft the solution using the tools that they had, and so all of their calculations are done in natively compiled procedures, which are very efficient. Hardware is running on a DL560 four socket, eight cores with a 3/4 of a terabyte of memory. Data and log files are using Fusion I/O drives. So I've mentioned in other sessions that often when you remove the rest of the bottlenecks from an in-memory OLTP system, what remains is I/O to the log, is the next bottleneck in line. So again, they got that going as fast as they could using extremely fast I/O for the log. Because they need availability of the system, it's supporting their marketplace. It has to be up all the time. They integrated with always-on availability groups in sync mode so that they have complete availability of the system. The application development time was actually a process that was re-implemented as we brought features online and refined. So we worked with them in partnership throughout the development of SQL 14 TAP. Results with the in-memory OLTP, it was 2 times faster, 115,000 TPS versus 52,000. Still investigating latency. There's some latency issues that they and we are working to nail down. We think we can get that faster. They can scale even higher if they have on different hardware. We've had them in the labs on some test machines in Redmond, and we can get faster results. So that's another avenue that they can explore. One of the interesting scaling effects that they saw, we've talked about the NUMA issues and the QPI communication issues between the cores, and they ran into that with a 4-socket machine. With 2 sockets, they were able to peg the CPUs, utilize all the CPU resources that they had. They moved to a 4-socket machine, and were only consuming about 44% of the processor time. So it sounds good, right? Except that the 2-socket running 100% flat out was running faster than the 4-socket with 44% of the CPU, and that was largely because of the overhead in the QPI bus going between processors. There's a question in the back.
I was surprised that
So the question was, why was the two-socket faster than four-socket? And again, it was because of the NUMA issues when you're transferring data across the QPI bus. If it's just two sockets, it's a fairly fast path. When you get above two sockets, there's more hops if the processor needs to access memory that's local to another socket. So that's something that we're actively working on in the development group going forward, is to optimize for larger and larger machines. So we're looking at ways to get data locality in the sockets so we can get larger and larger machines still running as efficiently. Lessons learned. The application, when it started, was fairly chatty, and so they didn't get as much benefit as they expected. They resolved that issue by combining sets of transactions in batches. So they would, instead of processing one trade at a time, they'd pass a block of transactions in using table-valued parameters and process them all at once in a native procedure, and they got a significant gain using that strategy. They had some application modification to do to keep from running into write-write conflict, where they had multiple threads accessing the same currency. So they have one aggregation per currency, and they'd have multiple threads trying to update that currency's rows. So they were able to partition the workload out so that each thread handled a distinct set of currencies for their updates. That eliminated their write-write conflict, so they didn't have the retry issues that they did at first. As you'll note, the database size, only 8 gigs, was much smaller than what the whole total data set was. So they ended up doing, there's a paper that's reference there that you can read that shows how they dealt with the storage allocation. So they were able to manage that storage. They didn't have to keep the full set of data in memory. Lack of parallelism was something they had to take into consideration in their query design, something to look at in your testing to understand how that affects your queries. Understand what we've talked about before, that there's no alter, so you need to plan for that in your implementation. Understand what the cardinality is likely to be in your tables at steady state. If you're not sure, guess high. And the NUMA issues that we talked about. So that's kind of a bit about SBI liquidity. Again, one thing you'll note that's common across all of these customers is they initially approached it, looked at their data set and said, I've got this huge amount of data, and it's going to be a challenge to fit all that data in memory. When they really got in and analyzed the application and looked at where their performance issues were, the performance issues typically settled on a very small set of data. So typically you're saying tens to 100 gigabytes is what we see in most of the implementations by the time they get into production. So again, be targeted at what data you're moving into memory. It's all about putting the data in the most appropriate place. So put the really hot data in memory, data that's not going to be accessed and modified frequently. It can stay on disk. That's where it belongs. Some lessons learned, just a recap. You've probably heard this in other sessions. Confirm your application goals and bottlenecks. Make sure you know what your problems are. You know what your finish line is. Understand where you're going. Understand where you will get improvements if you're implementing in-memory OLTP. It's not in the connectivity layer that helps your application talk to SQL Server. That's the same whether you're talking to traditional tables, column stores, or in-memory OLTP tables. So that time you spend in that layer doesn't change. Where it does change is in the data access and query execution. So the more time you spend in the engine doing calculations and data access per trip in and out of the engine, the more benefit you're going to see from this technology. Transaction logging is always an issue with durable tables because we don't return the commit until we've hardened the transaction in the transaction log, so we're going to wait for that I/O to complete. If you have high latency in your transaction log, that's going to affect you, so consider that. And again, this is not just taking pages and stuffing in memory. That's not where the speed up comes from. The feature's called in-memory OLTP, but the fact that it's in memory isn't where your speed comes from. The speed comes from the fact that the architecture is different internally. All of these systems, all these customers had machines with memory footprints way bigger than the set of data that they chose to put in memory, and they got these huge benefits. If they kept them in traditional tables, that same data would have stayed in memory. There'd be no reason to page it out because they had plenty of memory. So it effectively would have been pinned in memory. But by using this technology, they got out of the locking and latching that was keeping them from making use of all the hardware that they had, and they also got much more efficient access through the use of natively compiled procedures. That's where you get the benefit. So it's all about reducing locks and latches. With a disk-based table, again, the more threads you start bringing into the solution, you hit a bottleneck where they start interfering with each other, causing locking and latching, and your throughput actually tails off. Whereas with the same workload in memory OLTP, because that interference doesn't happen, it just keeps scaling. We said it before, we'll say it lots and lots of more times, test with a realistic workload. How many of you, for your applications, have a test workload driver that drives your application in a manner that's very similar to production, very faithful, both in terms of the mix of access to the database as well as the scale? Yeah. So that's something to really think about. It's one thing to have a test harness that will test your application for correctness one transaction at a time. It's another thing to have a test harness that will test the performance at scale, and that's where you can find out where your issues are. I've had a number of customers come back to me and say, well, this technology didn't do me any good. And when I looked at their testing, the test runs that they did against the disk-based tables had never gotten far enough out to the right to run into any bottleneck at all. So when we removed bottlenecks with in-memory OLTP, it didn't do them any good because they weren't seeing the bottlenecks. Had they continued the test out as hard as their production machines were running, where their production machines are running into that knee in the curve, then they would have seen a huge difference. And so that's what I'm encouraging you to think about when you're looking at testing this stuff. Make sure that you've got a baseline that's pushing the system hard enough to see where your bottlenecks are, to see that knee in the curve. With that, I'm going to open it up for open questions to these guys. Rick had a few comments he was going to talk about his implementation, but any questions are welcome. Yes? Right, so the question is, we're moving off of 2008, considering whether to move to 2012 or 2014, we want to understand whether 2014 is going to give us the same performance we're used to with 2008, or if there's any regression without leveraging these new technologies, because if we can just move to the new version, then we can use that version as a springboard to look for implementing these new technologies, and I would say definitely go for 2014. Rick had.
Let me jump into that. But before I do, the gentleman that asked the question about the NUMA problem before approached me later if you're still here, because there's a little bit more to that story and I would like to tell you, but I think we're running out of time before I can. So now coming to yours. Regarding the main structure of the databases, the main relational structure, there is no real downfall in SQL 2014. The one thing you have to be aware of, but that has nothing to do with the in-memory OLTP, is that they're using a new cardinality estimator in SQL 2014 compared to 2012 and before. You can prevent that by running your databases in 2012 compatibility mode or below. But if you're running this in 2014 compatibility mode, there are some implications that you can have. There's a discussion ongoing right now about this, especially if you're using it in with ascending key systems and trace flags 2389, 2390, where you might have a little bit of a problem. But those can be circumvented just by reducing the compatibility level of the database. Other than that, and I have migrated my entire production system to 2014 by now, no issues.
So a bit more about cardinality estimator. There's a lot of work done to refine the cardinality estimator, change some of its algorithms. Anytime you change the input to the SQL optimizer, there's going to be winners and losers. It's a very complex system. By and large, systems are seeing performance benefits from going to the new cardinality estimators. In some cases, huge benefits. I've seen some large queries going from hours to minutes with the new, just with the new cardinality estimator. There's been some specific queries that go the other direction with the same magnitude. The nice thing is that there is a trace flag to revert the cardinality estimator only to the previous one without taking the compatibility mode down, and that trace flag can be applied at an individual query level. So you use a query hint that turns on that trace flag just for that query. So queries that have specific issues can use the old cardinality estimator. The rest of your system can go with a new one. Other questions? Yes.
Can you repeat the question? I'm not sure if I can stand
completely. Can you repeat the question there?
I saw the blob slide earlier.
Yeah.
Can you explain what the zombie problem was?
Okay, so it's about the zombie problem and the blob. The problem that you have is when you have a table that has a var binary max column in it, and you update that row, you update the entire row with one transaction. If you take that var binary max field out of the table to split it up into multiple rows, then you have the problem that you have one update statement in the original table plus multiple update statements in that other table. And unless you have one transaction around it, which will get you a lot of problems because then you're hitting the transaction log, you have the problem of if this transaction dies in the middle of doing something, you will end up with having that record in the first table and half of the records in the other table, or maybe not a single one of them in the other table, and then you need to figure out a way to get this consistent again. And this is a problem you don't have if you have this var binary max just as one field. So that's the zombie problem.
How
do I get over it? Well, there are two ways to do it. One is understand the application, which is what we normally do, because I know how it behaves and how it works. The other one is if you don't understand the application, you need to implement some kind of a poor man's locking. And this is the other thing. I've written a blog about this. There is a SQL functions called sp-getApplock. So take an application intended lock. And that's something we did most, more or less. We didn't use sp-getApplock because you hit the transaction log with that as well. We wrote our own hackathon-based implementation of getApplock and used that to synchronize the entire thing and build an internal locking process too.
So again, the reason that he went without, the other way to solve it, if you're using durable tables, is just put all that update in one transaction, so the whole thing fails or succeeds atomically. The reason he didn't do that is that he was using a non-durable table to get away from touching the transaction log.
Wait,
and
why would you touch the transaction log?
Because he's bounding it in a SQL transaction.
Only,
yeah.
Only
so. Okay, the question here is, why do I attach the transaction lock even if I'm only using non-durable tables? The problem is, in the way Hackathon is implemented, due to error handling and blob handling especially, we could not put all of this into a native compile stored procedure. So we had to do this in interop mode and in a normal normal non-compile stored procedure. Having this, I have every single statement running in its own transaction context, unless I put a begin transaction and commit around them. The moment I put a begin transaction in a stored procedure, what I will see is one record in the transaction log that says lob begin exact. Because at that point, SQL doesn't know if I'm only touching non-durable tables or if I will be touching others. So it has to write this begin into the transaction log, and that's what it actually does. At that moment, I hit it, and with the commit, I hit it again. It's only two little records that go into the transaction log, but those two records can be significant impact if everything else is running purely in memory. Thanks for the question, Jos.
Any other questions? Oh, one here.
Do you think if I use a mixed up on certain queries or on the database table can help the SQL server distribute the node instead of the sockets to take advantage of that?
So the question was whether you can use MaxDop to localize the query to a single core, right? To single socket. Actually, the queries that touch memory-optimized tables in SQL Server 2014 use MaxDop of one. They're only going to be single-threaded for each transaction, so setting MaxDop won't have an impact on that.
The problem with this whole thing of NUMA, and that's what I wanted to talk to this gentleman afterwards, you have to understand the architecture of NUMA. And once you do, you'll see why MaxDop doesn't help, why all the other systems that you have in place right now will not help. If you're interested, please join the discussion afterwards, because that will take 10 minutes, and I don't have 10 minutes right now.
I think one of the key pieces to understand here is when you're trying to get performance out of a system and you're taking something and you're doing double the performance, which is 2x or 10x the performance of it, that's a huge change in what that system is processing. So you start pushing the architecture of the machine past what you're normally seeing with a normal OLTP system with SQL Server. So the theme of running into all these other bottlenecks in your architecture comes down to, at those speeds, you're actually down to system architecture decisions and the actual architecture of your vendor's machine and what they've implemented in it that might be your bottleneck.
And to add to the statement that Mike just said, because you said virtualization before, I actually have a test case where I have a 1,000x increase in throughput by not using virtualization. And that might sound like a horrible thing, but if your 1,000x goes from 200 nanoseconds to 200 microseconds, then in reality it's not really that much. But that's what you're talking about when you're talking Hackathon.
We're sorry.
Have all our feelings.
The point is, we now have a mix of stored procedures and entity framework code. Are we going to have issues with error? I mean, you mentioned error handling has to.
So the question is, through our development cycle, we've got a lot of entity framework, mix of entity framework and stored procedures. Is that going to give us issues with error handling? So first off, as it sits by default, Entity Framework isn't going to work with Hackathon because by default their connection strings turn on Mars. Usually you can just edit the connection string and turn it off and it will work for you. More than that, it's not optimized. We are directly working with the Entity Framework team for the next turn of the crank for both products to make them work much better together. Likely the best answer is going to be looking at the code Entity Framework came up with and tweaking it. But
so from another application we've already migrated to Hackathon, I can tell you that it does work, if you turn off Mars, that is. But our application engineers are pretty good, so they do have this deadlock handling stuff all in their code, and if you have that, you have not a big problem. And what you have to understand is you do not and never have a consistency problem unless you're doing crazy stuff. So an entity framework doesn't do crazy stuff. Well, other than performance crazy. You will get the consistency. You will see in very high load scenarios a lot of strange error messages maybe in the application. But then if you're using entity framework and you have a high load application, you will have more problems than strange error messages, because I highly doubt that with entity framework you can even reach somewhere near where it really makes sense to have Hackathon. Having said that, I have an application that does, and that actually uses Hackathon a lot and entity framework, and it works perfectly fine.
Other questions?
Design around, and then for PCP considerations, that's a recovery you have to also. So I'm wondering.
So,
the
question is, looking at the different versions of high availability in Always On, both failover cluster instances and availability groups, they have different profiles within memory, because in a failover cluster instance, the SQL engine is not running on both nodes at the same time. Is running on one node, and when it fails, it starts up on the second node. And in that case, within memory, it has to load all that data off of disk into memory, which is where you also come to looking at disk I/O in those type of scenarios. Or with an availability group, that those transactions are moved from both servers and they're consistent, so that the engine's running on both nodes, and you don't have that same latency on startup problem in a failover. In your configuration, you also mentioned that using another process, using SAN-based replication to get to DR, and the question is, how would you deal with this in this scenario? I would deal with it in this scenario by using availability groups synchronously locally and using an asynchronous availability group in the secondary site for DR, and that's how I would handle it, and remove the right, and then remove the disk replication out of that scenario. The same. You can use in memory because you can't use the in memory with 2012. But the configurations for that number of nodes, the feature set is similar between the two versions.
So some other difference is in the always on for 2014. If you're using readable secondaries in 2012, there's a number of situations where the readable secondary will drop offline. You won't be able to query it. Even if it's healthy, if it loses communication just briefly with the primary, you can't talk to the secondary. With 2014, we've changed that so you can still see the readable secondary, even if it momentarily loses communication with the primary.
Yes.
So.
It was.
Right. It's.
It's just was how the system was designed, where in 2012, if the readable secondary couldn't communicate with the primary, it would stop, take itself offline, because it assumed that things were really bad and it could be behind. With 2014, we decided it was worth it to allow you to continue querying the readable secondary, even though it might be falling behind because it wasn't getting updates, but that was better than having it completely unavailable.
Also, for your case for BCP and all the nice features that are included in SQL 14, is you can have secondaries in the cloud. You can do backup to blob storage. So for your high availability, off-site recovery, you can implement all those nice features included. At DVI 382 to 45 p.m., we're going to cover cross-cluster migrations, Azure data files. We're going to cover managed backup, in-memory LTP, all the migration scenarios that we did in our project. So I invite you to go over there. Really interesting topic.
So the red light tells me I'm out of time. I'll be available after this to answer questions as long as you'd like. So thank you.